appreciate that you're here. We get to be here together. It's wonderful. So the fifth of the seven factors of awakening is joy. The term being translated from Pali, and I think it's the same in Sanskrit, is piti, P-I-T-I, piti. Which means seems to mean joy with some warmth, joy with some engagement and some intensity. Sometimes it's translated as a rapture. The rapture seems a little dramatic, I think, for us, a little loaded maybe. So maybe joy is good. And then, like in English, in Pali, the language that the Buddhist teachings were first written down in, sort of a technical language, partly constructed, really just to receive the Buddha's teachings extended from its original form. In Pali, they also have different words for other related mental factors. In addition to joy or piti, there's another one, sukha, which is usually translated happiness. And we've all heard of dukkha, right? So this is the opposite of dukkha, sukha, the opposite of dukkha, or an absence of suffering. Dukkha means suffering. And I found a little quote from the Visuddhimagga, which is this enormous, like, 1,000-page book from the 5th century, which is a very important commentary on these teachings. And Buddhaghosa in there has a little description of the difference between joy and happiness, between piti and sukha. So we'll see if this helps us or not. And wherever the two are associated, joy, piti, is the contentedness at receiving a desirable object, and happiness is the actual experiencing of it when received. Where there is joy, there is happiness, but where there is happiness, there is not necessarily joy. Joy is included in the formation of the aggregates, and happiness is included in the formation of feeling. And so it seems to be he's saying that the sukha or happiness doesn't depend on an object, that it's a little more sort of baked into the possibility of experience. And joy or piti has some kind of relationship built into it, he seems to be saying. Then he goes on to give an example, which didn't make a lot of sense to me, so we'll see if it makes sense to you. If a man or woman, exhausted in a desert, saw or heard about a pond at the edge of a wood, he would have joy. If he went into the wood's shade and used the water, he would have happiness. So you're exhausted, you know, like the guy in the cartoon in the desert. You hear about the pond in the edge of the wood, you have joy, this sort of energetic, you know, yes, joy. So there's some relationship to an object. And if you went or she went into the wood's shade and used the water, she would have happiness.
Satisfied.
Yeah, satisfaction maybe. Yeah, maybe sukha has an element of satisfaction or contentedness. And then there's a whole third word that we have to figure out, or not, how this parses out. Because the fifth factor of the seven factors of awakening is this joy, this piti. Sukha is not in the list, but it's important to mention. The sixth factor, the one after joy, or piti, is pasadhi, which means like calmness. Or the translation I have been using in the list is lightness and ease. So somehow that fits into all this. And so here we have three different mental factors with distinct meanings: piti or joy, sukha or happiness, and pasadhi or lightness, ease, calmness. And I don't think I'm going to try to sort of tease them apart any more than that tonight, or maybe I don't know enough to do anymore. But one quality I thought of that seems germane is we can think about a sort of internal temperature, sort of an internal temperature of these different desirable and pleasant states. It seems like this piti or joy is pretty warm, you know. Some excitement maybe, some warmth, some joy. So the English word joy has a quality, I think, of warmth. And because it's joy in the path of awakening, joy in the service of enlightenment and practice, we're grounded, you know, we're grounded by our meditation. So it's joyful, it's warm, but it's also grounded. And the what they're describing, it doesn't have any elements of suffering or grabbiness. So it's not exactly excitement, I think, because excitement for us always has an element of agitation and an element of maybe even a little bit of fear, right? You're excited and there's an element of fear. When am I going to lose this happy state? So this is just the positive side of that. And of course, in practice, it's always all mixed together, right? We don't have any sort of pure and separate states. It's like any sort of dichotomy or categories. It's a little bit arbitrary. And so it might be joy is warm, this piti, and it might be that the pasadi, the calm, the tranquility and ease is cool, much cooler, a sort of contented sort of happiness. And it might be that sukha is sort of not residing within this continuum of temperature. Sukha might in some way not exactly have temperature or be all temperatures. Be that sort of pivot point where we don't need those kind of gradations. And so we should think about happiness a little bit. The Buddha is suggesting that we should cultivate and uncover or empower joy. So this is not just all like hard slogging through the zazen, you know. And just like let go, you know. Nothing left, empty, right? So he's saying joy, well, there's some warmth here. And happiness seems to be something we all want. It's in our national code, right? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Our national credo. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is sometimes quoting as saying that Buddhism is all about our basic human desire not to suffer, and to be happy. But what's interesting is we have some desire or some goal or some interest in happiness, but we mostly really don't know how to get there. We don't really have a path to happiness. Sometimes we think about happiness. We think about what could I get or have or do or change or not do so there'd be more happiness. But it seems to be that the way our minds are constructed, thinking about happiness doesn't seem to help us be more happy. Maybe even the opposite. And there's a raft of psychological research that seems to back this up, that thinking about happiness does not make us happier. And my theory about that is that that thinking about happiness sort of shifts the ground and puts us into a kind of a subject and object kind of modality where I'm over here probably not too happy and there's some happiness somewhere that I want to get. If I can sort of get something, X, Y, or maybe Z, I'll have more happiness. But if, you know, on the contrary, if A, B, or C happens to me where I don't get, I'll have less happiness. And then once we're thinking about happiness as a kind of an object that can be influenced by other objects, and, you know, physical objects or even mental objects, maybe we think if we had more calm or more peacefulness or more people respected us or something, these are mental objects, or, you know, maybe just like a really good cup of coffee, we'd be happier. And what's interesting, I think, about once the mind has identified these sort of contingent objects and happiness itself is being identified as an object, then what happens, and here's where I think it goes astray, is the mind very quickly goes into a kind of an evaluation mode, right? And starts to try to figure out whether we're making any progress, right? The mind wants happiness, and if we want happiness, we probably don't have it, right? Otherwise, what would we want? So then the mind is going to try to figure out, well, is it working? You know, are we getting more? Are we getting more happiness? And I think what's interesting about the mind that evaluates in that way is that it's really good at some things. That mind that evaluates, am I making progress? Am I getting there? There's some things that that mind is really good at. Like, for instance, that mind is really good at helping us get across the street. We don't think about this because it happens like so automatically, right? So gracefully. We're on this side of the street. We want to go to the other side of the street. Everything happens and we're at the other side of the street. Very rarely do we get run over or forget, you know, and just stand in the middle of the street for an hour, you know. We usually make it to the other side of the street. And the mind can just do everything it needs to do, right? It can cognize our position in space. It can hear sounds. It can smell smells. It can see sights. It can instruct our legs what to do and our head about what to do. And it can, and most importantly, what our mind can do is it can evaluate whether we're getting closer to the other side of the street, right? And then, you know, and then it's like this little loop, and it can keep sort of doing all the different steps that need to be done. And incredibly, you know, the mind can do this with total precision, even if we aren't even paying that much attention. And these days, we have many walking psychology experiments of people getting across the street while talking on their cell phones, right? So they're not paying attention whatsoever to the street or what's around them. They're, you know, focused on their conversation, and yet somehow the mind is able to do this and get them across the street to this incredible system of evaluating and adjusting and manipulating, right? And I was thinking about that and how I do feel judgmental of people doing that. But then I realized, well, you know, that's sort of silly because probably everybody crossing the street with or without a cell phone is so preoccupied by their inner chatter that they're not paying attention whether they got a cell phone out or not, you know? But somehow, you know, we trust in the mind, and same with driving, right? There are not car accidents every second, you know? Somehow the mind has this incredible ability to do this kind of goal-oriented processing, kind of a differential processing. And so naturally that same mind is at play when we're trying to figure out if we're happier. But then the problem seems to be that since there are no sort of positive and clear markers in the mind for the mind to look at in deciding whether we're happy, the mind really doesn't know if we're happy. And the mind starts looking around, you know, rattling around, looking under in the cupboards and under the rocks and stuff. And the mind is pretty quickly able to see plenty of evidence that we're not happy, right? Many problems and obsessive thoughts and bad memories and mistakes that we're making and things we could have done better, right? And so the mind is soon awash in lots of evidence that we're not only are we not more happy, we're getting less happy. We're really doing it all wrong. So it seems like our thinking evaluative mind is not going to help us to cultivate joy or be more happy. Maybe yours does. That would be nice. That's great. You don't need to do Buddhist practice anymore, though. You're good. But for the rest of us, for the rest of it, it seems like that's not what we need. So it's good to notice this and see, you know, what really in our life, what ways of being, what actions of body, speech, and mind, what choices actually do lead to more joy, to more happiness. And the Buddha was constantly in his teachings reminding us to really pay attention not to our idea of how we think it goes, right, or our idea of how we think it should go. The Buddha was always reminding us to pay attention to cause and effect, what actually happens. We do something, and then there's a result. And most importantly for us, and really essential for us to practice and bring into the world, the Buddha understood that the actions that lead to results include inner actions, include thoughts, include mental states, include attitudes, that those things really matter. That the Western sort of modality posits a huge separation between like sort of physicality and mental or spirit or something like that. And the Buddha didn't really see it that way so much. What we think about and how we work with our thoughts is an action and it has a result. So we can study that. Some thoughts or impulses or ideas or emotions that arise seem to increase joy and some seem to decrease it. And after a thought or an emotion or an impulse arises, then what? You know, then something happens. Then we make additional choices. And those additional choices can hugely amplify or modify or diminish the results. How do we hold a thought? What energy do we put into a thought that arises? How do we attend to it? Or, this is really good, or what if we don't attend to that thought or emotion at all? Because there is an option that we notice in Zazen practice, and we can develop through our practice, that we don't have to hang around in that thought. We can move our attention somewhere else, to some other aspect of our experience. That in Buddhism we understand our experience as being a sort of flow of moment-by-moment sensory experiences. And the thinking mind, and the mind that can sort of cognize the thinking, is just one of many choices. We also have what we see, right? And what we hear, what we smell, what we feel outside, inside the body. So we can move our attention to these other aspects of our experience, which are happening all the time, right? But when we're caught, you know, in a kind of ruminative way in our thinking, it's possible to become completely unaware of the rest of our experience. And we all have I think we've all had that experience. So this is really interesting. We could simply choose to pay attention to something else. And this is challenging because it runs a little counter to several of our deeply held ideas. One of our deeply held ideas is that we really should be able to fix and solve everything, or at the very least have some kind of closure, Why am I always thinking these obsessive thoughts about such and so? Why shouldn't I be able to resolve this? Why shouldn't I have closure? And I think there's nothing wrong with closure and resolution. And I think closure is a more or less recent idea in our culture. And it probably arose as a really important sort of antidote or response to another cultural tendency, you know, from a little bit earlier in our history, to just deny everything, right? And never talk about feelings and, you know, ignore the way, you know, all the problems and so on, and just kind of put up, right? Put up and shut up. So I think we came up with this idea of closure and talking things through and all this as a response to denial, which is really good. But we take closure too far sometimes. We think everything should be able to be tidily sort of solved and sorted out. And who do we task with this sorting and solving? That same mind, right? That same mind that's really good at crossing the street and really stinky at solving these things in her mind, right? So it might be that we can soften a little around closure and soften a little around trying to understand why things are the way they are, and instead work with experience directly. Move attention to the breath. Leave something alone. Move attention to the body. Move attention to our activity. And spend less time in our thinking. And all of this becomes hugely more possible if we don't buy into as fully the idea. So here's the second thing that holds us up, I think. If we don't buy into as fully the idea that our thinking is us, that my thoughts are me, and that I am the sum of my thoughts. That's my personality, that's me, you know? So if I am me, and a really stinky thought arises, then I can't ignore that. That would be, you know, that's it. Me can't ignore me. Like, then there would be no me, you know. So it's sort of baked into our sort of me-ness, or ego, if you want to use that term. I want to learn more about what Freud meant by ego. Ego, the word ego gets used in Buddhism, but it's a Western word, so I'm a little curious whether it's skillful to use ego. Some Buddhist teachers do use the word ego. And they seem to sort of personify ego as this little kind of child in our head, like having tantrums, you know, trying to get what it wants. So maybe that's useful to think about it that way. But the more we can reduce our identification with our thinking and soften around thinking as me and shift our attitude and our relationship to our thinking, where thinking is a little more just an event, like the weather. You know, Norman often used that a metaphor of thinking and emotion as weather. You know, we may not like it, a cold, rainy, you know, day when it's 39 degrees, but it's not like offensive, you know, or upsetting, you know, it's just, it's the weather, right? And yet when we have a judgmental, angry thought, or somebody talks to us in a way we don't like, you know, it's offensive, right? It's upsetting, partly because of that identification. So a release from identification makes it more possible not to chase our thoughts of happiness into unhappiness. So one way of approaching this question of cultivating and allowing this mental factor of joy is working more skillfully and more patiently with our thinking and really taking that on as practice, as activity. So it's something we actually have to work with, you know. Because it's not good enough to just say, okay, from now on I'm not going to worry about my stupid thinking, you know. That doesn't, you know. So we have to practice with this over and over and over again, on the cushion, off the cushion, identifying a thought as a thought, an emotion as an emotion, noticing when there's space to make choices in our relationship with all this inner activity, to notice when it's possible to be skillful in how we sort of invest our energy. Where is our energy going? And it is really remarkable, if you pay attention, and I'm sure you all do, how much energy a ruminating thought loop can absorb. Have you noticed that? It's like astounding, you know. It could probably power whole cities with that energy, you know. And it actually is, like, you know, they can measure how many watts are going on. So that's one way of approaching joy, working, thinking about the thinking process and what kind of thinking is skillful and so on. Another way of thinking about joy or approaching joy is engagement. More fully engaging with our activity in the present moment, joy seems to be naturally emerging or liberated from a full connection and relationship with our actual life as it's unfolding. And this connection and relationship seems to operate on lots of different levels. Right away when we hear relationship, we think about our relationship between, you know, a relationship between people. I think this is largely because of our identification with our self. When we hear relationship, our first thought is relationship between, you know, this self that's very important, kind of the center of the universe, and those other selves are probably somewhat important too. So that's where we start, and it's a very good place to start because we are in human relationships. This is very real and very important. But how can we engage in these relationships in a full, in a fully present and integrated way that allows for joy? And this one, this second way of working with joy, full engagement with relationship, is of course completely connected to the first one, right? And which makes me think of, I was watching a little bit, it's unbelievable how much stuff is like online, right? I mean, we'll be saying that every year for the rest of history, like next year we'll be like, ah, oh, it's unbelievable. So I was watching this little bit of, and just the different combinations things that happen, things that are happening online. So here's what I was watching. I was watching Thich Nhat Hanh give a Dharma talk at Google Corporation. Online, you can see this online, and it's like this hour-long program. They have this whole thing with singing before he comes on. It's very beautiful. You should watch it. I didn't watch all of it, but I watched about half of it. And Thich Nhat Hanh comes on there, and you know, I'd never seen him speak in person, and I had never I'd heard a little bit on the radio once, but it's the first time I'd seen him speaking. And you know, as you'd expect, very sweet, you know, very grounded, speaking very simply. And his whole message for these super smart Google engineers was, you have to be here. That was his whole message, you have to be here. And he started out talking about relationships, he was talking about love. And he said, he has this sweet accent, you know, he said something like, because if you want to have a love relationship, you must be there. If you are not there, you will not have it. And he just said that in lots of different ways. You know, it's beautiful, you know. Here's somebody who's like kept to a very simple, beautiful message for like 50 years of teaching. Like, amazing. So these two things are related, right? We can't be fully engaging in a human relationship and allowing joy to emerge if we're caught in our own stuff, right? If we're caught in our own thinking, we're not there, you know. But a relationship with other people is just like one of many relationships, right? What about our relationship with our senses? How about our relationship to the feeling of a breeze on our cheeks? You know, why is that any less important a relationship than a relationship with another person? How about our relationship to seeing something? To really seeing something, you know, really fully. And sometimes you have this experience, you know, just spontaneously or during a retreat, you know, like you really look at something, right? It's unbelievable, you know, a tree or a weed or anything, you know. Wow, what a joy. And how about our relationship between, you know, our self, whatever that is, and even like other parts of our body? Like if you really pause and really feel the body, it's the body when it's still, the body in motion, really be curious about what is this, you know, to be embodied. That's a whole kind of relationship, and it can be so joyful and interesting. Like the actual feeling, you know, like really feeling, what is it to like hold something, you know, to really feel that. And that possibility, you know, the miracle that your hand can pick something up and feel it, you know, feel the physicality of it. I mean, that's a whole relationship right there, and very joyful. That's another thing I always repeat, is I remember Norman saying at one point that when he started practicing in Berkeley when he was in his early 20s, some reason he had this idea, some poem he read or something, that he really wanted to like learn how to feel his hands. So I always think of that, like, wow, you know, feel your hands. So, that's the second way of cultivating joy, but one more, a third way. So first we had awareness of our thinking and our emotions with less identification, more skillfulness, and maybe more just setting aside. Second, about relationship and at all levels. And then my third possible way I'm suggesting, and you may have other ways, I'll be interested to hear, of cultivating joy is letting go of desire, letting go of desire, working very creatively and directly with desire. So this is a little bit backwards from our conventional view, because we associate like satisfying desire with happiness, you know, getting what we want, right? That's, you know, kind of prima facie, like the first way we think of, right? If I get what I want, I'll be happy. But check this out. You should practice this and see what you find out. Because this is really wonderful if this, when this ticks over. Other times, really excruciating, really difficult practice, but really good practice. Because these are really deep patterns. We're deeply patterned around desire. And right, remember that's one of the five hindrances too. So the next time you get caught in desire, and it can be like a fairly minor desire that, you kind of know, it doesn't really matter, you know, if you get something. I don't know what it is for you. Or it can be a pretty, like, serious desire where you really, like, it is essential, you know, that something happen or not happen or be received or heard or said or something like that. You really get caught in a desire. Try to really notice that feeling, like, identify it, like, oh. Like, we focus on the object, right? We focus on the object. When is she going to get it together and, you know, such and so, whatever it is, right? But instead of focusing on the object, see if you can focus on the experience of desiring. And see if you can really recognize that desire as desire. And really step right out of justifications and reasons, you know, why you deserve this, or why you've been hurt by that, or why it would be better if it was this way and not that way. So really step out of that and see if you can see desire arising as an experience. And then there's a couple of possible ways to practice. If you actually, you know, once in a while, you have to kind of get lucky. Like, oh, this is desire. Because we so quickly are invested in the, you know, the object, you know. And we're so sure that we're right. So one possibility is doing nothing. Doing absolutely nothing. Just being right in the middle of the desire. you know, breath might be helpful. You know, you can still breathe. You got to breathe. You know, awareness of breathing with breath is good. But just let the desire wash over you, wash through you. Just let desire ebb and flow. And here we're really counting on putting our faith in the sort of reality of change. It's going to change, right? It's definitely going to change. And so interesting to see if we can stop like running around trying to satisfy desire, because that gives us the possibility of noticing that it's not so monolithic and static, that it changes. It's not going to last forever. It's going to shift in some way. So that's one possibility. Identify the desire and just be right in the middle of it. Do not satisfy that desire. Do not like convince yourself that you didn't have to satisfy it. Like, don't talk yourself out of it. That's a whole other kind of trickery, you know. Just be in it, you know. Suffer if you gotta suffer, but it's beautiful, you know. It's beautiful. And the other path, even more counterintuitive, is do the opposite. Do the opposite of what you want. And this is a really powerful practice and can be really helpful, actually, in human relationships. And I actually recently had a powerful experience of this on vacation. You know, I was so convinced that I was in the right and I was upset, you know, with somebody, and that she should really do the thing I wanted her to do. And I was able to notice, you know, I got lucky, I was able to identify desire and just kind of somehow, like, I was like, push my sort of self, you know, ness aside for a moment and just do what she wanted to do instead, you know. So do the opposite. Make the first move. You be the one to apologize, even though that mind that like gets all wound up is convinced that they're the one who should apologize. You apologize, you know. They're the one who should make the first move. You make the first move. You know, you pick up the phone. You know, do the opposite, you know. You know, give away the wonderful whatever it is, you know. Give it to somebody else. So do the opposite of what the desire seems to be telling you that you should do to get whatever the heck it is you think you're going to get. You know, do you even know what you're going to get when you're caught in a desire? You know? You're probably wrong anyway. So you be the one, you know, to pick up the pile, the messy pile in the house, to take the kids to soccer, whatever it is. And then feel what happens. You know, this is not just like a sort of a dogged, like, self-denial thing. It's a subtle distinction there. This is not self-denial, but it's an exploration. It's a, you know, it's a practice, exploration of desire. And see if there's joy, you know. See if joy emerges. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. And of course, human psychology, you know, is complex and the mind is complex and there's many factors, right? And sometimes we hear about these things and we expect a simple fix, and of course we don't get that. But it's an experiment, you know. It's an experiment. Seeing what happens when we pay attention, experiment, and see what happens again. And in any case, all of these seven factors that the Buddha said support awakening, this being the fifth one, are all about showing up, really. And as we get into the last three factors, you know, the first four were kind of about the sort of grounding and effort and the sort of, you know, heavy lifting. These last three factors are kind of about the light and the joy and the sort of result of all this. So the last three factors are joy that we talked about just now, the very related tranquility and ease or calmness, and then the last one is concentration, you know, samadhi, really deep presence, deeply being present. So there's a kind of a skill to this and a kind of, you know, a joy to it. And some fun, you know, some fun. I had a heated little discussion with a Zen colleague on Facebook, of all places, about fun. Some of my Zen colleagues probably think I'm a real dork, you know. That's good, I'm trying to just enjoy that. She had done this, like, arduous pilgrimage that they have in Japan. One of the southern islands of Japan, Shikoku, it's the one just south of the main island of Honshu. There's this famous pilgrimage route. It's the Kobo Daishi pilgrimage route. It's like 118 temples, and the real hardcore pilgrims do it by walking, and longer than Mount Rainier. Yeah, it's like 40, it takes 45 days. That's the standard pace, is 45 days. So she finished this and was put a picture on Facebook, you know. Did in the winter too, hardcore woman, you know. So I asked her, so did you have fun? And she's like, it's not about fun, you know? Yeah. So I try to, you know, be respectful. So, yeah, yeah. Thank you. It's a deeper thing than fun, but, it, you know, it's fun. To have less suffering, you know, and more engagement and more curiosity and more delight. And of course, you know, none of this is light or easy exactly. We can't do this without deeply feeling our suffering. You know, you don't get one without the other. So we have to be more and more willing to experience the full range of experience, right? So there's more joy arising when we're more fully present for suffering, for our deep and dark places. But even still, you know, there can be a little fun. So lastly, I'm out of time, I guess, but I just want to mention something else quick, two something else's. One is I want to mention practice period coming up in 2 weeks. I have a nice piece by Dogen I was going to read, but I don't have time. Dogen's a big fan of practice period, as you can imagine. So maybe next week I'll read you a couple of pages from Dogen, you know, 1,000 years ago, about practice period. So it starts in 2 weeks. Next Wednesday will be just like this, and then the week after will be the opening ceremony, and we'll install a talus as shuso. That'll be fun. And we really need your help, so please come that night. It's really important. And we also all get an opportunity to reflect together about what we're going to do or how we're going to practice or not practice or during a practice period. And there's a lot of, there's a sign-up thing on the internet, on the website, and we'll send some emails out really soon. So that's practice period in just 2 weeks. Lasts for 6 weeks. And then lastly, I wanted to say a little homage to Paul Warwick, one of the two founding teachers of the Shambhala Center in town here, although they've since kind of retired from Shambhala Center. Paul has severe leukemia, and he probably lived about another month. And I was a little out of the loop. I just found out a couple of weeks ago that this was going on, and I got to see him on Tuesday morning, New Year's morning, and spend about an hour with him, which was wonderful. Really generous. I wrote to Jenny and said, I don't want to impose, but I'd love to see Paul again. And he really wanted to see me. And I think partly through me, talked to all of us. And he really spent some effort telling me some things. And he has a kind of unusual way of expressing himself, so I don't know if I can exactly sum up what he told me in so many words, but it had a real resonance and a feeling. And I really felt something about what he was telling me. But he's pretty happy now. He's experiencing joy, actually. It was a joyful occasion to be with him. He had done, as often happens, I guess, with cancer, you know, if you're not going to really pull out of it, they do all the interventions and treatments for a while. I know some of you worked in hospice and know people, so you know about this, but they had just stopped doing all the treatments. And so he's kind of had his mind back and was more relaxed and... weirdest thing, I guess. He's an oncological mystery, I guess. His bone marrow just like switched off. They don't understand why. Mm-hmm. So no white blood cells. And when your white blood cell count goes low enough, your body kind of just goes into shock pretty suddenly sometimes. Really high fevers and cognitive sort of weirdness. And then he stopped having red blood cells too. So he's like got nothing but platelets in his blood, I guess. And low red blood cells mean you just get really sleepy and cold and, you know, no oxygen is moving around. So yeah, he basically has no immune system and very little oxygen. But once they stopped all the sort of transfusions and treatments and emergency room visits, he got to be a lot happier. And Jenny said that she really was relieved and that he really was more clear and was more himself. Basically what he told me is trust in emptiness. Really trust in emptiness, that practice hard. You know, he's a real advocate of serious practice. And I think he's, you know, he's a modest person, but, you know, I think he and Jenny both, you know, I think they do like a couple, 2 or 3 hours of practice a day and have done for decades, you know, especially once they retired from their day jobs. And he also said, prepare for death, you know, prepare for death. Practice with that in mind, that you really, you know, as the Buddha said, you know, death is certain, only the time of death is uncertain. And he said, interestingly, for the last 2 or 3 years, Paul has been very actively teaching about death. He's been doing workshops and seminars and classes, but his understanding of the Tibetan teachings about death. And he did want to let us all know that the popular Tibetan book of, what is it, Living and Dying or whatever.
Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Tibetan Book of the Dead, that's it. It's a little misunderstood and not the whole thing. So he said people are all, I think he swore a little bit actually. He said people are all fucked up about the Bardos. That's not how it is. Yeah, so if you want to know about the Tibetan system, he said study more than that. And he said, I don't hear if he was talking to me or all of us. He said something like, this life and Buddhist practice has a hard edge to it too. He basically, I think, was telling me, don't just make it soft and nice, because that won't really serve us in the end. We need to go deep and be willing to be corrected, be willing to be humble, and to be willing to suffer. So he did, I think he was kind of, he and Jenny really liked the idea of like hard-ass Zen teachers that like pull the rug out from other people. And of course, I don't really have much training in that, so I don't really know how to do it, but he was encouraging the strong side of practice, that we not shy away from that. So I just want to dedicate this talk and our practice tonight to Paul and thank him for his many decades of practice. He was one of the original students of Chogyam Trungpa in the, I think, the early 70s in Colorado. And, you know, I think he really remembers Trungpa Rinpoche like it was yesterday. And what he said about Trungpa Rinpoche was that Trungpa was pretty hard to be around. He said, when you were about to go see Rinpoche, you couldn't wait. You were so excited. You just couldn't wait to be with him. And then when you were in the room, you just wanted to get the hell out of there, and you were stuck. But you always learned something, and you learned something really important, he said. And he has a calligraphy on his wall that Trungpa Rinpoche made, this big calligraphy, which is this abstract, I might have to make my own version of it, it's this abstract kind of spiral kind of thing with a sort of, that's kind of a big spiral, and this kind of line, big diagonal line, and then a kind of return. And he said that Trungpa Rinpoche said that this shape, it isn't really a character in Tibetan or Chinese, means courage. And he never really knew why it meant courage, but he says the more he looks at it, the more he feels that it means courage. And he feels himself actually kind of falling into that shape as the days go by. He's sitting in his room with this to look at.